This is the podcast for Wednesday, January 6th, 2010, Theories of Knowledge. Unfortunately, our sterling discussion in class yesterday was cut short because my battery on my laptop ran out. So I'm going to be giving a summary of what we discussed in class and do my best to give you the gist of our debate and discussion. And we were continuing to discuss the correspondence theory of truth versus the relativist theory, and that just the nature of truth and knowledge in general. To begin with, we had a discussion about whether the correspondence theory of truth says that truth is what most people believe, and that's definitely not true. That's the cultural relativist version of the relativist theory. So the correspondence theory of truth says that truth is that which corresponds with reality, or that a true statement is one which describes the world the way it is, as opposed to the way it seems to be to most people, or the way it appears to be. And the correspondence theory says that truth is independent of belief, of thought, of all human consciousness, that to say something is true is just to say that's the way the world is. And if you think about ordinary discussions about from the mundane things in daily life to more sophisticated questions, any dispute of a matter of fact, that both parties presuppose that there is some truth, and they are giving arguments or evidence to support their view about the way the world is. They're not merely sharing subjective sensations or feelings or thoughts, but rather when they're engaged in some sort of a dispute of a matter of fact or in an intellectual conversation, they're trying to get at what the truth is. And the truth being something objective in a reality which they both are a part of. Now, many people mistakenly see the relativist view as more broad-minded and more open to the truth. But actually, when you think about it, in a conversation, it is relativism which closes off discussion, because as soon as you say, oh, well, that's just my opinion, or that's just my personal belief, you've changed the discussion, you've closed off a discussion of objective truth, and you're reverting to talking about your personal subjective feelings, which of course another person can't criticize, because you feel what you feel, you believe what you believe, and in many contexts it's used as a defense mechanism. Oh, don't criticize my beliefs, because if you're criticizing my beliefs, you're criticizing me. Whereas if you're talking about the objective world, you're really not engaging in personal attacks, but you're talking about ideas which a person holds and not attacking that individual. And so intellectual discussion is about a shared objective reality, and the correspondence theory of truth fits in with this. The relativist theory also can be seen as a sign of intellectual laziness. How hard is it to get knowledge as a relativist? Well, whatever you believe, you know. What's true is true for you. Whatever thought pops into your head, that's your truth. Or however things seem to you, that's what's true for you. There's no need to go to evidence or arguments or do research. Whatever seems to be true to you is true. But if you consider that belief, doesn't that seem in some way absurd? Can you make something true just by believing it's true? And we talked about a number of examples of this in class on Monday about the money in your bank account, whether the traffic is clear when you're crossing the street. And you can apply these same questions to whether, say, going into Afghanistan was a good idea, or whether the Iraq war was a wise foreign policy decision. And the only difference between those and how much money do I have in my bank account, or is it safe to cross the street, it's just a matter of assessing the evidence is a lot more complicated. You're relying on secondary sources as opposed to your own senses in the case of crossing the street, or pretty hard data when you're dealing with the bank. And so it's just a matter of how complicated the issue is and how difficult it is to tell. But there's no difference as far as what truth is. Other people will say sometimes that the correspondence theory of truth seems dogmatic. You're saying, this is what the truth is. And if you don't believe this, you're wrong. And actually, the correspondence theory of truth doesn't make any judgment about what things are true. It just says, this is what truth is. Truth is the way the world is. It doesn't say that, for example, I give the example in class because I regard it as an uncontroversial example, and it turns out that this wasn't the case, that whether or not the shaman's beliefs about epilepsy being caused by evil spirits was true or not. I said, if you grew up in an isolated Stone Age culture, as you know, existed into the 20th century in South America, and you grow up in a village with a shaman, you might have a reasonable and justified belief that the village shaman works with the spirits and that he can cure disease, and it might be rational and reasonable for you to put faith in him if that's all you've known. But I would think that in 50,000 years, human beings would have learned something more about the world. And so now we have modern science, and with that, modern medical science, which can show that epilepsy is a disorder of the temporal lobe, and it can be treated with medication and sometimes with surgery. And we show that these treatments are efficacious, and we have a broad theory which explains how the central nervous system works and how epilepsy is a form of a disease or dysfunction in that system. Very different from the shaman's approach, which is based on supposed supernatural entities with consciousness. His treatments have typically a temporary effect. And what's more, science can explain through the placebo effect, through psychosomatic effects, the effect of the witch doctor's cure. But the witch doctor can't explain the greater efficacy of the neuroscientist's cure. Now, someone in class suggested, I believe that sometimes epilepsy may be caused by evil spirits. What does the correspondence theory of truth have to say about that? And what the correspondence theory says about that is that either evil spirits sometimes cause epilepsy or they don't. And there's a matter of fact in dispute here. And so what we should do is put forth arguments and evidence, and engage in a rational discussion about what the truth is, as opposed to this sort of childish thing where we say, well, here are my beliefs, I'm sharing my beliefs, what are your beliefs, and to treat people as if they exist in their own individualist or cultural metaphysical bubble, as if they were living in different worlds, when if you have two people sitting in a room with different points of view, they're in the same world. They're in the same universe. There's no metaphysical difference there. And so there is a matter of dispute. What is the cause of epilepsy, or say disease in general? Is there a spiritual world? Are there malevolent spirits which cause disease? And so you can have a discussion as to, well, why do you believe evil spirits do cause disease? And the person might give some evidence for that. And then the person that believes has a more scientific viewpoint and is skeptical about the existence of evil spirits might say, well, have some contrary evidence. Or perhaps say, well, just because you had such and such experience, does that really mean that such and such entities exist? Or might there be a better alternative explanation which fits the data in a better way? And so then, again, you can have a rational discussion about what the truth is, but that presupposes that there is a truth to be had. The correspondence theory doesn't say one way or the other which is the true belief. It just says that there is some truth in the matter, and either it's one or the other, or sometimes you have multiple competing theories. With the evil spirits, it's a question about, once you quantify what a spirit is, either they exist or they don't. and I talked about in class the idea of a God. The correspondence theory of truth does not say there is a God. It does not say there isn't a God. What it says is that either there is or there isn't a God. And this is what Aristotle, the philosopher Aristotle, called the law of excluded middle. And the law of excluded middle says that any meaningful, well-qualified statement is either true or false. There's no sort of in-between. A statement can't be both true and false, or neither true nor false. If it's meaningful, if it's not vague in its expression, if it's well-qualified, it's either true or false. Again, someone in class suggested, well, what if it's a person's personal belief? Well, what does that mean other than the person believes it, or they believe it very strongly, or they've believed it for a long time? A belief is just a mental or attitude, and it's a mental attitude about a proposition. Propositions are either true or false. Depending on the way the world is, if the world includes a God, then the statement God exists is true, once you define what you mean by God. If the world doesn't include a God, the statement's false. Now, it may be that there's no way to tell whether there's a God or not, and I wouldn't say that that's necessarily true, but that may be the case. It may be that at the end of the day, we have the pro arguments and the con arguments, and the best we can do is say, well, it's hard to tell. And actually, then you might say, well, we should remain agnostic, and we shouldn't believe one way or the other if we can't prove it. And that's generally, you know, what you would do in a case where you're not forced into a decision. It seems that if the evidence is ambiguous, what you ought to do is suspend your belief, to say, well, I don't really know what the case is, or it might be this and it might be that, but you would withhold your assent if there's no way of proving something. But proof is a different question from truth. And if you think that maybe there's no way to know there is a God, that does not mean that God exists is relative, or that God can exist to a certain person. What it means is that maybe you're adopting a skeptical viewpoint. You might say, well, we can never know whether there's a God or not. And a skeptic says that truth exists, truth is objective, it's just that it's very hard to come by. And so the skeptic, it's important to understand that the skeptical approach is very different from the relativist approach. The skeptic says that knowledge, or true justified belief, is very hard to come by, because although they believe that certain things are true about the world, they are skeptical about us ever knowing those things or being able to prove those things. But still, they agree with the correspondence theory of truth that the world is one determinate way, and that some set of propositions will describe the world at any given time. Now, someone else in class suggested, well, doesn't the truth change? At one time, the world was flat, and then at a later time, the world was round. And I asked the question, well, was the world really flat? And of course it wasn't. People falsely believed the world was flat, and then new evidence came to prove that the world was actually round. Same thing with the Earth going around the sun. At one time, people thought the sun went around the Earth, and then new evidence. And actually, if you look at the world cultures, have actually gone back and forth in this. Many of the ancient Greeks believed that the Earth revolved around the sun. And Aristotle, the philosopher Aristotle, actually even considers this proposition and gives some arguments against it, but he sees it as a possibility. And so, but what happened is over time, people came to realize that the Earth goes around the sun. Now, the consensus or majority of people believing that the Earth goes around the sun is not what made that statement true. That's what led to us knowing that statement is true, but that statement would be true whether human beings ever existed. Now, there would still be a planet, even though it wouldn't be called a planet because there wouldn't be any people to label it as such. There would still be a big flaming ball of gas called the sun, although no one would have ever called it the sun, and undergoing a fusion reaction, and the Earth would still be spinning like a top on its axis at 23.5 degrees. That was true before human life ever evolved. You look at, say, before the earliest forms of man came about on the planet, it was still true that the Earth revolved around the sun. There just wasn't anyone to know it. And when human beings were living in caves and hunting the woolly mammoth and so on, we were around to think, but no one had the evidence that the Earth revolved around the sun. And so truth does not change. It's our perception of the truth that changes, or our understanding of the truth, which changes. And so, now sometimes truth changes in this respect, in that the world is always changing. So somebody in class gave the example, they had a cup on their desk, and they said, now the cup is here, and they move the cup, and they say, now the cup's there. But didn't the truth change? And my reply to that is that you should think about statements or propositions as being indexed to time. So if I say, you know, we're talking about the proposition, it's raining outside. Once we qualify what I mean by raining, you know, how much, whether we're talking about like big droplets or kind of a mist or whatever it is, we can qualify that. And then we can check and see whether the statement is true or not. It's going to be true or false depending on whether it matches up with what I mean by the statement or what the statement means. Now, also, though, would we say that my statement went from going true to false if it's raining and then it stops raining? And I think what we should say is that if I'm making the statement now, I don't bother to say it's raining outside right now. Because I don't mean it's raining outside tomorrow, right? Otherwise, I would have said tomorrow. So any statement or proposition is an index to time, whether it's stated or not. It's typically implicit in the statement. Although sometimes people do make statements about the future. And those statements will be true or not based on whether those future events come to pass. So if I say, it will rain tomorrow, then my statement is true or not based on whether it rains tomorrow. So if you think about, if a statement is well-qualified, if it makes sense, if it's meaningful, and if it is indexed to time, it will have a truth value. Now some things, like whether it's raining or not outside, those things are easy to tell. Whether there's a God or not might be a little more difficult. Whether, a judgment about foreign policy, about whether we should send more troops to Afghanistan, a little more difficult. We talked in class about historical judgments, and people put various degrees of probability in those things. I talked about the example of the Exodus. There are no historical records in Egypt of the 10 plagues and the Exodus and large numbers of Hebrew slaves leaving Egypt. Now, you do get some evidence of a massive migration and or invasion of people into Palestine, the land of Canaan, in the mid-15th century and also the mid-13th century. And so there's archaeological evidence, but it's somewhat ambiguous and difficult to piece together, fragmentary, and so on. And there's no records of the Exodus from Egypt, and so there you might have to just say that we don't have enough evidence. And the same thing may be true. We might know, say, Caesar crossed the Rubicon in 46 BC. Maybe we have some pretty good historical accounts that tell us about that. But maybe there are other things that we're not really sure about, like how did the prophet Muhammad die? Muhammad blamed some stomach ailment he had on his poisoning by a Jewish woman, and that may have led to some long-term health problems which killed him, or it may have been something totally unrelated, and there was no one to do a modern-day autopsy on the prophet Muhammad, and so no one really knows. And there are a lot of mysteries of history that people love to delve into, which are interesting just perhaps because we don't know. And so that doesn't mean that there isn't some truth in the matter. For example, there is some truth in the matter about what George Washington had for breakfast on July 4th, 1776. Now, we may never know what that is, but, George ate something, or he didn't. Maybe he had nothing for breakfast. There's some truth to the matter. It may just be that we never know what it was. And we look in his, say, we find his diary, and there's no entry for July 4th for the or there is, but it doesn't mention what he ate for breakfast. And we just may never know that. But still, something happened then, and the statement which described what happened there is true. And statements which describe things other than they happened are false. Now, we've been spending an awful lot of time on this question about the nature of truth. I'd like you to understand that this is the most fundamental distinction in not only philosophy, but in all forms of learning and intellectual discussion. That unless you accept the correspondence theory of truth, intellectual discussion is impossible. All you can do is have somebody, you know, pull out the guitar and sing Kumbaya and share your feelings. But to have a rigorous intellectual discussion, to do philosophy, is to have a dispute, or, you know, perhaps just a conversation where you would express your point of view, but to have a discussion about the nature of truth, and to understand that a contradiction can't be true, and that two contrary views cannot both be right. And the goal of philosophy and of intellectual discussion is to try to move closer to the truth, to make our beliefs more closely match those of reality. And the way we do that is through argument and evidence and so on, but all those things are there not to defend our own point of view, or not to validate our own subjective feelings, but rather to get a more accurate picture of the world. And that's really what I think education ought to be about, getting a more accurate picture of the world. The correspondence theory of truth assumes that some people will be wrong. And again, there's no shame in being wrong. Certainly I've had beliefs over the years which I have revised because I came to understand that they were wrong. And it may be that in the future I may revise my beliefs and about things I believe now, and after thinking about them and reflecting on them or coming across some new piece of evidence, I might decide that I was in error. Hopefully, if you form your beliefs in a careful way, based on the best available evidence, and avoid the pitfalls of defensiveness and rationalization, you have beliefs which will be more, as opposed to less, reflective of actual reality. Sometimes people say, well, who am I to judge? Well, you're a person with a rational mind who's able to make intellectual judgments, to assess evidence, to think critically and analytically, and to come to some conclusion which might be different than the conclusion of your neighbor. And that's perfectly okay. And it may turn out that you believe that your neighbor is wrong. That doesn't mean you have to be rude about it. If you have a dispute over a matter of fact, you don't need to be rude or even dogmatic about your view. You might just, you know, respectfully say, well, I see things differently, or I think you're wrong, and here's why. And I think you shouldn't see that as anything that's disrespectful, as long as it's done in a courteous way. And in some ways, you respect the rationality and the self-restraint of another person. If you do disagree with them, you're treating them as an adult. You're treating them as someone who is not threatened by contrary views. And you're having the self-esteem yourself and the self-assuredness to disagree with another person and to express your point of view. And the idea is that if people in a courteous and fair-minded way discuss topics about which they disagree, both or several parties will learn and have a more accurate picture of the world. We had a little discussion in class about the difference between an experience and a belief. So an experience is something that happens to you subjectively, and But then there's a further question of what your interpretation of the experience is, what it means, and the beliefs or judgments you make based on those experiences. And so I gave an example of a person I know who's schizophrenic, and he would hear these voices talking to him. And at one time, he thought the voices were real. After he got on his medication, or back on his medication, he said, "Oh yeah, I went off my meds and I had this long schizoid episode, and now I'm perfectly okay. And I realized that when the voices were talking to me, that was, you know, my diseased mind, and that the voices aren't really real." And so, even though he still remembers having those experiences, he makes a judgment that those about what those experiences mean, that the voices weren't really demons or malevolent spirits talking to them, to him, and telling him to do things, or telling him he's a bad person, and so on. But those were his brain misfiring and causing him to have hallucinations. Someone else in class talked about taking mind-altering drugs and having different experiences there. And they asked the question about whether, how do we know our perceptions give us accurate information about the world? Perhaps our perceptions are inaccurate, and if we drop acid, we'll be in touch with the true reality. And what I said about that is that the correspondence theory of truth doesn't make a judgment about whether your senses are reliable or not. But the very ability to ask the question about whether your senses are reliable or whether your senses under the influence of some drug are more reliable or less reliable presupposes a correspondence theory of truth. Because what are you doing when you're asking, are my senses more reliable in normal circumstances or when I'm tripping on acid? To ask that question, you're asking, do my sensations correspond more closely with the way the world is under normal circumstances or under the influence of drugs? You're asking a question which presupposes the correspondence theory of truth, because what you're asking is, do my beliefs match up more closely, or do my sensations match up more closely with the external world under normal circumstances or under the influence of drugs? And that presupposes there is an objective world and that your sensations can be closer to or farther away from that world, that they can give you more accurate or less accurate information about that world. Again, the correspondence theory of truth doesn't presuppose whether there's a God or not, whether astrology works or not. And what I was doing in class when I bring up that, or in the text when I talk about disease being caused by evil spirits, I use that as a fairly non-controversial example of a belief which the evidence seems to show that it's false. I suppose that it's the same way the Earth going around the Sun is just a similar example. Or the example of me flipping my lucky coin in order to find out who's going to win the presidential election. There may be some people that believe in lucky coins. The correspondence theory of truth does not make a judgment about whether flipping a lucky coin is a good or a bad way of divining the future. All it says is that that a statement about the future will either be true or false based on what happens in the future. And so one of the two things will be true. Either, say about the President Obama's re-election. It's either true or it's not true that President Obama will run for a second term. And it's either true or not true that he will win. That true or not true does not change when you're talking about something which is more difficult to tell, like whether there's a God or whether there are absolute moral precepts that apply to everyone in every respect, regardless of their culture or conscience, or whether the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan were a good idea, whether capitalism is better or socialism is a better economic theory, and so on. Those are a lot more complicated questions, and there is an agreement on them, but that doesn't mean that the truth about them is relative. What it means is that there is some statement or some of statements about those things, which are true. It's just there's no agreement about what is true. But again, agreement is not the same as truth. Consensus is not the same as truth. Truth is the way the world is, regardless of any human perception or conception or thought about it or belief about it. Truth is independent of belief. Now, seeing that the relativist theory goes against all common sense and is not acted on in ordinary life by most people, why do people accept it? I think a number of reasons. One is government schools. Government schools think... Pardon me. Government schools prize diversity and tolerance above all the other things. They tend not to encourage critical and analytical thought. They tend to encourage collectivist thought, obedience to authority, respecting other people's beliefs no matter what they are, and so on. And so in this climate, it should not be surprising that most students find the relativist view to be seem intuitive. And society at large, I think also in America particularly, thinks that the worst thing you can do to a person is to criticize them and to tell them that they are wrong. And you have to worry about hurting their feelings. And the most important thing in the world is self-esteem. And so all these things feed into this general climate of relativism. People who do not want to be judged as being immoral by others will often use relativism to deflect criticism of their ethical or moral behavior. They could say, well, ethics is relative anyway, so what if I did whatever it was? Morality is relative. So that might be part of the explanation of why relativism seems so attractive to students. And you can be tolerant, though. You can be tolerant without necessarily accepting another person's belief as true. You could say, well, that's what they believe, and they're entitled to their belief. I disagree. You may even see their belief as being foolish, but you don't have to tell them that. And you can accept their right to believe it. You could say, well, I don't want the government to control what they believe or what they say, and I just have a contrary opinion. And that's really what liberal society used to all be about. It was about liberalism, was about accepting of many viewpoints and about the freedom of the individual to speak the truth as they understand it, to engage in a discussion with a peaceable discussion with those who disagree, freedom and liberty each person has to speak their mind without fear of persecution or prosecution from the government, including freedom of religion and political freedom, and those things are part of the foundation of the government of the United States, right, enshrined in the First Amendment. So if I've failed to persuade you of the truth, of the correspondence theory of truth, for the purpose of this class, I'd like you to pretend that the correspondence theory of truth is true, starting in week two. Because really, that is a precondition of discussing any philosophical question. Because to discuss a philosophical question is to talk about whether something is true about the world or not, or true about the universe, true about the true about existence, if you like. So I'd really like you to go over carefully the first chapter. It's very short. Make sure you understand the correspondence theory of truth. Make sure you understand how it says that truth is different from what most people believe, what seems to be true, what you personally believe, and that it says that truth is the way the world is, that a true statement describes the world as it is as opposed to as it is not, and that a false statement is one which describes the world other than it is. Also, make sure to go through the section on relativism, and I'd like you to make sure you understand the argument that relativism is self-referentially incoherent and what that involves. And there's a section on knowledge. I want you to understand that knowledge is true, justified belief, to understand that a belief could be true and not justified, or it could be justified and not true, but in order to count as knowledge, it has to be both true and justified. You should understand that if a belief is actually known, if it counts as knowledge, it's necessarily true. That's a necessary component of knowledge. And that, to be true is not enough, because your belief could just be true by accident, or you could have a belief which turns out to be true, but you could have really bad reasons or justification for believing it. So in order to count as knowledge, your belief has to be both in fact true and also based on really good reasons, arguments, or evidence. And finally, I'd like to take a look at the Gettier problem. I know that's don't puzzle too much over that. The gist of the Gettier problem is that it's a problem for the traditional definition of knowledge. So the traditional definition of knowledge is that knowledge is true, justified belief. The Gettier problem shows that sometimes you can have a belief which is both true and justified, but intuitively doesn't seem to be knowledge. And it has to do with the way the truth of the belief and the justification of the belief sort of hook up. And so just realize that there's some objections to the traditional definition of knowledge. And there's a whole corpus of literature of people trying to make allowances to the theory of knowledge get around the Gettier problem. And I think most philosophers regard it as a technical objection, and one that really doesn't defeat the traditional definition of knowledge. This is why I say that knowledge is, roughly speaking, true justified belief. There may be some cases where there's something missing that we need to add there, but really we're talking about nuance or detail. The broad understanding of knowledge is still that of it being true justified belief. So just a reminder of a couple of things. Make sure that you post before Sunday, 11:55 p.m. to the Week 1 Forum on Chapter 1. Also, if you plan on dropping the class, make sure you do that if you want your money back by Sunday midnight. And finally, make sure that you get into Chapter 2 for next week. We'll be talking about rationalism and Descartes' meditations on both the Monday and Wednesday. And all the, those of you in the hybrid class, I'll see you then. Online students, I promise I'll get the lecture up in a timely manner, as I did on Monday. As I said at the beginning of this recording, my laptop died in the middle of class, and the entire recording is lost, and that's why I'm doing this little fireside chat here to make up for it. So I hope this is hasn't been too boring. I know that the interchange in class can sometimes be more interesting, hearing me interacting with other students. But I hope I've covered most of the material that we talked about in class, and this will reinforce what you read. If you have any questions about the class, about the course mechanics, testing, requirements, or feel free to send me a message in Moodle. If you have a question about the subject matter in Chapter 1, that would be a great thing for you to post in the Week 1 forum. And it may be answered by another student, or I may end up answering it in the forum. And that's a proper venue for those questions. If it's not answered in the forum to your satisfaction, feel free to send me a private message. That's it for today.